gonna pass, I got a handout here. And depending on how many people show up, we might or might not have enough copies, so if you can share one to a family, that might be appreciated. And it's just 6:15, so let's get started. My name is David Mazenbring. I work as pastor for Church in the World Ministries at St. Mark's Cathedral in Seattle. I'm a Lutheran pastor at an Episcopal cathedral. The series, last week and this week, I called Blind Spots Among Fools for Christ. Things that we don't see. That's about the only thing that ties them together. Maritime ministry, Israel-Palestine, theology of mission. What was Saturday, Friday, the late one? Anyway, ecumenical life was one. And now we start three sessions on related to the eradication of global poverty. Today's session is called the Millennium Development Goals. We are the first generation that has the capacity to end at least extreme poverty. There are people who think we could end poverty, period, but I'm not going to be so provocative. I'll just settle for ending extreme poverty. We have the capacity, we have the know-how, we have the resources, but do we have the will? And in particular, do the people who have the resources and the know-how have the will? I tried to provoke your attendance in the description of this session by saying that around the world, people are praying that Americans would learn about the MDGs, but we don't see much about it. I should have asked before, I've already biased your answer. How many people are familiar? I mean, there are 8 goals. How many could list at least 3 of them? 2 of them? How many? Let's start with a lower bar here. How many have heard of the Millennium Development Goals? Okay. And how many could list one of the goals? All right, so good. You're an easy group to leave better informed when you walk out of here than when you start. And you've got in front of you, and let's try to take care of the others who come in. Are there extra copies somewhere?
Right here.
There you go. All right, so once you keep them back there, and if people come in, can you hand it to them? And the same thing if somebody comes in the door here. Hand them a couple more copies. Oh, right there. The Millennium Development Goals come out of, they were adopted by 191 nations at a summit in 2000, convened by the United Nations. They set up 8 goals. We'll talk about them in a minute. There have been 2 other major conferences that are related to this. One is the 2002 Monterey Conference on Financing for Development. How do you pay for the development of the world that will eradicate extreme poverty? And then in 2005, there was a World Summit because we were 1/3 of the time passed. In 2000, the world community, including the United States, signed on to a commitment with 8 goals and 17 targets that are quantifiable, measurable efforts to reduce global extreme poverty in the world by 2015. So that's the goal, to reach these targets by 2015. And 5 years into the 15-year commitment, there was a third big conference held. A couple of things about the conference. They created a map that breaks the world into regions. So they talk about Western Asia and Southern Asia and Eastern Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, North Africa, Latin America. They break down the world of extreme poverty into regions so that they're not tracking the whole of the developing world, but they're tracking. They're collecting data from individual regions and seeing which regions are making what kind of progress. Back in the 70s, some economists pointed out that if wealthy nations gave 0.7%, so 0.7% of their national income, if they devoted 0.7% of their national income to investments in the infrastructure, health, and education in poor nations, those poor nations would be able to get on the path to self-sufficiency. In 2000, the UN adopted this target for the Millennium Development Goals. The United States has rarely given more than 0.2% of its income since the 1970s, and recently has given less. By 2007, last year, about halfway through the 15-year period, only five nations had managed to reach that 0.7% of their income goal. And those five nations are the Netherlands, Luxembourg, and the three Scandinavian countries, Denmark, Norway, and Sweden. We'll talk a little bit more about U.S. funding for this a little bit later. I said there are eight goals with 17 quantifiable targets, and they're listed on the back of your handout. And we're going to go through them in just a second to kind of see what they mean and how we're doing, as best we know at this point in the process. They're not perfect. Some people have pointed out that they don't address the problem of racism, for example, or the distribution of power, or the export of arms. That was one subject that a few powerful countries insisted not be put on the table. And when we talk about U.S. foreign aid a little bit later in this presentation, you'll see why. So I've looked at two sources of information that draw on other sources of information to put together the information that I have. But, you know, it's a big world, and we're talking about very complex summaries of global conditions. So I'm going to do the best I can, but it's not a perfect science. The first goal has two targets, and it's important to note that the target they're using, I believe, is that one, well, let's read it. Have the proportion of people living in extreme poverty by 2015. Some of the data that I was looking at defined extreme poverty as the people living on $1 a day or less. I saw something today for another presentation I'm preparing for tomorrow, a report from the Gates Foundation that says 2.6 billion people, what are there in the world, like 6 billion? 2.6 billion of the world's people live on $2 a day or less. I did not come up today with the figure of how many live on $1 a day, but it's a lot. And according to the UN and their numbers, overall, in 1990, about 28% of the people lived on $1 a day or less. And by 2003, that figure had lowered to 19%. Dramatic improvement. The reason is primarily because of dramatic gains in China and East Asia. In those parts of the world, income has risen dramatically since between 1990 and 2003. But in sub-Saharan Africa, it has lowered. It's gotten worse. So there's an example why you got to break down the regions of the world that you monitor here, because some may do better and others do worse, and the overall may reflect an increase, but there may still be areas that are worse off. And that's the case with this target. Second target there, somebody read it for me, so you don't have to just keep listening to me.
Have the proportion of people who suffer from hunger by 2015.
Right. And on that subject, this study guide from the National Council of Churches says that despite some progress on hunger, global progress is not fast enough to meet the goal. The proportion of undernourished adults in developing nations dropped from 20% in 1992 to 17%. But that still represents 815 million people who remain undernourished. Surprisingly, half of the world's undernourished are farmers whose plots are unable to provide their needs. 20% live in the burgeoning urban slums, 40% of urban inhabitants, which are now home to more than 40% of the urban inhabitants of developing countries. So 20% live in the slums, 20% are landless rural dwellers, and 10% are pastoralists, fishers, and forest dependent. Second point, child malnutrition is declining, but not fast enough to meet the goal. So it's getting better, but we're not on track to have the numbers of hungry people in living in extreme poverty. Half the children under 5 in developing countries are underweight, stunting their physical and mental development. Of the 300 million children who went to bed hungry last night, fewer than 8% were victims of famine. The others suffer from chronic long-term malnutrition. So that's an example, one goal with two targets, and a little bit of data on where we are. Someone read the second goal.
Achieve universal primary education.
Universal primary education. Let's see how we're doing. Progress toward this goal is mixed. Though in some parts of the world, almost all children are in school, in 2001, an estimated 115 million children were still out of school, the majority of whom were girls. 8 out of 10 of these non-school children live in Southern Asia or Sub-Saharan Africa, where rapid population growth is making it difficult to keep up with demand. In this study guide, there's one whole box on, you know, why should we work on poverty when the real problem is overpopulation? And there have been movements in this country focused on curbing population growth. But what they've learned is that the key to curbing population growth is to improve the welfare of people. Better educated and better off people have fewer babies. In the societies where children are not able to go to school, or where these high populations, 8 out of 10 of these non-school children live in Southern Asia or Sub-Saharan Africa, your future security lies in your children. There's no social security system that's going to take care of you when you can't work and take care of yourself anymore. So you depend on your children to take care of you, and there's a high infant mortality rate. We'll hear more about that in a minute. So you have lots of children in the hope that some of them will survive and be able to care for you. When your circumstances are better, when your education level goes up, particularly for women, then you have fewer children. AIDS has exacerbated the education crisis in Africa. In 1999 alone, 1 million children in Sub-Saharan Africa lost their teachers to AIDS. Literacy rates are the lowest in the least developing countries and among young women. We said that. The net enrollment ratios in primary education went up to 86% in the developing world, ranging from a high of 95% in Latin America to a low of 64% in Sub-Saharan Africa. All right, the third goal.
Promote gender equality and empower women.
Good. And would you go on and read the target as well?
Eliminate gender disparity in primary and secondary education, preferably by 2005, and at all levels of education, no later than 2015.
Okay. And I found that 2/3 of the world's 800 million illiterates in 2004. So in 2004, there were 800 million illiterate people in the world, and 2/3 of them are women. And how are we doing on the target? Seven out of 10 regions are close to parity in primary school enrollment between men, boys and girls. but others lagged seriously behind. Between 1990 and 2002, the greatest progress was achieved in the regions where the gap was the widest. In Northern Africa, for example, the enrollment ratio of girls to 100 boys increased from 82 to 93, pretty significant, during that 12-year period. Southern Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, and Western Asia lagged behind in secondary as well as primary education. There are very few places where girls have access to higher education. Where they do, in our country for example, they sometimes outnumber the boys. The gender gap in access to higher education reverses itself in many developed regions like our country, where 124 girls are enrolled for every 100 boys. But overall, in most of the developing regions, gender disparities become larger as students progress in their education, from primary to secondary to higher. In 65 developing countries that have complete data, about half of those 65 countries have achieved gender parity in primary education, but only 20% in secondary and only 8% in higher education. I already said that 2/3 of the world's illiterates are women. Literacy is a fundamental skill that empowers women to take control of their lives, engage directly with authority, and access the wider world of learning. The largest literacy gap is in Southern Asia, where women's rates are 19 percentage points lower than men's. All right, that was goal number 3. Somebody read 4, both the goal and the target for us, please.
Reduce child mortality by 2/3, the under age 5 mortality rate, to be reduced by 2015.
The good news here is that there's been a 3% annual reduction in Latin America, Caribbean, Southeast Asia, and East Asia, and North Africa. The bad news is that in 2004, 10.5 million children died before turning 5. 45% of the 10.5 million lived in sub-Saharan Africa. Say there's more information here. Reductions in the under 5 mortality will require dramatic increases in immunizations and other interventions for preventing disease and caring for children. Those include improvements in health services, access to clean water and adequate sanitation facilities. We'll be talking about that issue on Friday. I will be. Relying exclusively on breast milk for the feeding of infants under 6. Now you ask why until you study the marketing strategies at mission hospitals by European and American companies in the maternity wards who gave away infant formula in high volume to mothers in the hospital, hoping that the breast milk would dry up, and then the mothers would be dependent on purchasing that milk, and then because of their poverty situation, they watered down the concentration, and the result has been extreme malnutrition. But big profits for those of us who invest in those companies. And increased access to treatment such as antibiotics for pneumonia and appropriate drugs for malaria. That's what it's going to take to make more progress on that goal, which between 90 and 2003 has been uneven, with sub-Saharan Africa lagging behind. Fifth goal. Anybody?
Improve maternal, sixth.
Number 5.
Yeah.
Number 5.
Improve maternal health.
Right, and the target?
Reduce by 3/4 the maternal mortality ratio by 2015.
This one, I did not find much data. People are hesitant to comment much on it. And it appears that because, and they say that the accurate cause of death records makes this very hard to monitor. The most widely available indicator is the proportion of women delivering with assistance from a trained attendant. In other words, because death records don't often cite the cause of death, you don't always know how many women are dying giving birth, in childbirth. But it appears that the best indicator is whether or not a skilled attendant is present at the birth. And skilled attendants present at birth has been increasing significantly between 1990 and 03 in the developing world as a whole. Whether it's enough to meet the goal, we don't know. How they're going to measure that goal is tough. Urban women are twice as likely to get antenatal care, which is critical. In other words, if you get antenatal care, people can ferret out many of the cases where the mother's life is at risk in childbirth, and you can take precautions to make sure that when the childbirth comes, she's surrounded by the care she needs to survive. But urban women are twice as likely to get that care as rural women. So the delivery of medical services to rural people is the big issue. We'll hear more about the factors inhibiting that in a few minutes. The sixth goal.
Combat HIV/AIDS, malaria, and other diseases. By 2015, halt and begin to reverse the spread of HIV/AIDS. By 2015, halt and begin to reverse the incidence of malaria and other major diseases.
So note that the goal here is to halt the spread. That is a modest goal. I mean, it's a major problem, but we're not talking about ending the problem. We're talking about halting reverse the spread. And at this point, the data is not too encouraging. The worst affected region is sub-Saharan Africa, home to nearly two-thirds of all the people living with HIV. There's a growing number of children orphaned by AIDS. Around 15 million children under 15 had lost one or both parents to AIDS by the end of 2003 in Africa, Asia, and Latin America and the Caribbean. That number is projected to nearly double by 2010. Between 1990 and 2003, the number of children in sub-Saharan Africa who lost one or both parents to AIDS increased from less than 1 million to more than 12 million. It's a huge issue. Bob.
Could you give a little geography lesson about where East Asia is and sub-Saharan, South, Southern Africa?
Yeah, I was, no. No, but I can tell you how you can get that geography lesson. If you turn your page over, we'll say more about this in a minute. The second resource listed there, mdgmonitor.org, is an initiative of the United Nations Development Program. And there, that website, which is spectacular, will easily help you map the world. And it has the regions noted, and you move your cursor over the country in that region, and it tells you what countries they are. But East Asia is like Vietnam, Southeast China, and down there Vietnam, Laos.
That's Southeast Asia there.
That's Southeast Asia. So there, the map that's listed here, which doesn't tell you the countries, so it just reflects the ignorance of that.
I think South Asia would be India, Burma, most likely.
Right. Eastern Asia, I believe, may just be China. China, and above it looks like maybe southern part.
Japan.
Well,
Mongolia,
over to
Mongolia.
Mm-hmm. That area, as opposed to Southeast Asia. Does that help, Bob? Your best answer is to go to that MDG Monitor website, where they have the map. And they have it broken by region, and then you can see which countries they put in the region.
Sub-Saharan, from the equator all the way south?
North of the equator, from the Sahara Desert. So usually they distinguish North Africa would be Algeria, Morocco, Egypt. Sub-Saharan Africa starts with Senegal, Guinea, Gambia, Liberia, Sierra Leone, Ghana. Togo, Nigeria, Niger, and down, over to Kenya, Sudan, south.
All the way down?
All the way down.
So you don't refer to South Africa or Southern Africa?
Well, you could, but, and Southern Africa, it has the worst incidence of AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa. So the region that the UN is looking at for these purposes is below the Sahara. All the nations south of the Sahara, most of the African nations. But there is a material distinction to be made between conditions south of the Sahara and conditions north of the Sahara. The Arab North African states, for example, are better off. Morocco is much better off than Rwanda. Does that help?
Thank you.
All right, let's go on to the, what number are we on?
Seven.
Please read seven, and that has three targets, so let's just read the goal and read the first target for me, please.
Ensure environmental sustainability. Integrate the principles of sustainable development into country policies and programs, and reverse the loss of environmental resources.
All right. And one more item I forgot to mention under the previous goal is that tuberculosis is enjoying a resurgence in the world. It's growing by, cases of tuberculosis are growing about 1% per year. So we're having trouble with that goal. Progress on target 9, they number these targets, and that's the one you just read. Integrate the principles of sustainable development into country policies and programs and reverse the loss of environmental resources. Progress on that target is measured in 5 areas related to sustainable development. 1, the management of forestry resources. And the world during the 90s had a net reduction of 2.4% of its natural forests. Sustainable management of forestry resources. 2, the preservation of biodiversity and genetic resources. 3, the efficient use of energy. 4, the greenhouse effect, which is linked to global warming. And 5, damage to the ozone layer. The only one that the global community is confident it has made dramatic improvements on is the reduction of the rate of consumption of the ozone depleting substances. Consumption of these substances dropped from about 1.1 million tons in 1986 to about 91,000 tons in 2002, a dramatic reduction. The greenhouse effect is a worse story, not the least because the U.S. rejected the Kyoto Protocol soon after George Bush came into office, calling for reductions in carbon dioxide emissions. Somebody read the target 10.
Have by 2015 the proportion of people without sustainable access to safe drinking water and basic sanitation.
That is the subject of the session I'll do on Friday, called Water Wars. So stand by for that one. Target 11.
By 2020, achieve a significant improvement in the lives of at least 100 million slum dwellers.
I was surprised to learn that there are 924 million urban slum dwellers in 2001. And without intervention, that number is scheduled to grow to 1.4 billion by 2020. The eighth goal?
Create a global partnership for development with targets for aid, trade, and debt relief.
All right, and this is where it gets closest to home, so. Hear me. We'll break it down to aid, debt relief, and trade. And you see there are several targets there, I think 5 in all. Under aid, the issue is to keep our promises, I think, is that Is that the target?
No.
Develop further an open, rule-based, predictable, non-discriminating trade. I'm not going to go through them target by target. I'm going to, they're broken down differently in this study guide. Under aid, the issue is to keep our promises and give development aid at the levels we've agreed to. There is great publicity when the White House, after much lobbying, announces it's going to participate in a massive aid program for AIDS, for example. Nobody reports on whether or not that promise is kept. There are countries that are ready and able to make good use of the funds. For example, Honduras, Mozambique, and Niger are among the countries whose plans to dramatically increase the numbers of children in primary school have met the international criteria and been improved for implementation, but were stalled for lack of donor funds needed in 2004 and 2005. The U.S. and other donor nations promised to give 0.7% of their annual income. But as of the most recent statistics available, the U.S. gives less than 0.2%. Meanwhile, the U.S. spends roughly 50% of the total global military spending. We spend as much on military stuff as do all of our allies, all neutral countries, and all of our enemies combined. Use development aid to reduce poverty and not to accomplish other goals. The average annual per capita income of the three countries that receive the most development aid from the United States are Egypt, Russia, and Israel. The average per capita amount of that aid is $10,800 for every citizen of those countries, Israel, Russia, and Egypt. And these are not the poorest countries, but it's deemed expedient for our foreign policy to structure aid for strategic purposes rather than to address issues of global poverty. And the international community is saying, use development aid to reduce poverty, not to accomplish other goals. Thirdly, under aid, the world community wants us to decrease the amount of aid tied to the purchases of goods and services from the donor countries. It's widely known that in the case of American foreign aid, Congress requires that all of that aid be spent, is to the greatest degree possible, on purchasing goods and services from U.S. companies. Well, guess what? It's cheaper to buy them locally. And when you buy them locally, not only does your dollar spread a lot farther, but you strengthen the local economy, and profits go into the development of those countries instead of enriching ourselves with that paltry amount of foreign aid. This is a little bit of an aside, but I can't help mentioning that one of the strongest documentaries I've ever seen is called Why We Fight. How many have seen it? You can get it from Netflix. Why We Fight. Starts with Eisenhower's speech. His last speech to the American people, in which he coined the term military-industrial complex, and with profound interviews with his grandchildren and those who are part of his library and who have studied his legacy, they go into detail about how prophetic he was in foreseeing the development of the military-industrial complex, but that he missed. He did not anticipate the increasing role of lobbyists. And the documentary makes the case that between the lobbyists, the industry, and the military, you have a juggernaut spinning out of control that has spread around the gravy train in this country so that virtually every congressional district has an interest in those military appropriations. And it is what we live on. And it is just such a legacy contrary to how we think about ourselves. Debt relief. In 2003, low-income countries paid $39 billion in interest and received only $27 billion in aid. This is not from the United States now, but this is globally. How many are familiar with the debt, the campaign to end to forgive debt? Maybe half of the people in the room. So I'm just going to give you one example. Yeah, but I urge you to pick up this book in the bookstore called The Poisonwood Bible. How many have read that? Great novel. Great novel. Great literature, and very insightful for how we have functioned in one country. That's today called Congo. When I visited, it was called Zaire. The democratically elected president of Zaire was Patrice Lumumba in the 60s or 70s, sometime in there.
60s, Kennedy was president.
Kennedy was president. Lumumba is elected, democratically elected, in this newly independent country that was then called Congo, and since, and the CIA was collaborated in a plot to assassinate the guy because he was deemed to be a socialist, and that this was not good for a country where U.S. mining interests were so extensive as the Congo. Of course, we didn't say we're doing this to protect the mines. We said we're doing this to protect the people from socialism, which is basically the same as communism. So the CIA collaborated in a plot. The body of Lumumba actually rode around in the trunk of the CIA station director's car for a while until they could figure out what to do with it. And this is laid out in the novel, The Poisonwood Bible, but actually the facts that she uses there are true, are documented, are historically well documented. Then we bring in this guy, Mobutu, who it was felt would be a reliable, better player. Mobutu became one of the most corrupt leaders of any country in history. And once he's in power, the Western bankers start flying into Kinshasa and offering massive loans for the development of the country, knowing full well that the guy was completely corrupt and was stashing huge amounts of these loans in his own personal bank accounts in Switzerland. He was, I remember landing in Nice once to do French study, and his jet was on the runway. He had these massive villas in the south of France, and when he traveled, it was with a whole 727 jet full of family and attendants. Fabulously wealthy man. All right. Eventually, he dies. Today, the people of Zaire are being held to the repayment of interest on the massive debts that were negotiated with Mobutu. Those countries, I got a good stat here. In Tanzania, no, that's the, here we go. The All Africa Conference of Churches says, quote, every child in Africa is born with a financial burden which a lifetime's work cannot repay. The debt is a new form of slavery as vicious as the slave trade. The cost to the United States of canceling most debt for the world's poorest countries would come out to about $1.20 per U.S. citizen. The long-term effects of the debt burden on poor countries is to sap their ability to develop their own capacities. I thought, oh, here we go. No, that's untrue. I am sorry, because I thought I had a stat on how much, maybe it'll show up later, how much more Africa spends on debt relief than on paying interest to Western banks than it does on their combined education and healthcare. One of the greatest reasons that Africa is locked in this poverty is the requirement by our countries that the debt be repaid. Debt that was, in many cases, very negotiated by very questionable ethics. But it worked. Tanzania, many of the agreements about debt relief call on recipient nations to combine the money freed up from interest payments with new allocations to health and education programs. So that where some debt relief is being negotiated, the deal is, okay, we'll relieve your debt, but you have to make a commitment to put that money into healthcare and education. In Tanzania, the result has been extraordinary. Primary education was made free and compulsory in 2002, and an extra 1.6 million children started attending school. Keep in mind what we said earlier about the relationship between education and getting out of poverty. Trade. So we've talked about aid, we've talked about debt relief, let's look at trade. Open domestic markets in donor countries to goods and services from the developing countries. This is a very sensitive policy issue in the United States. Developed nations spend about $1 billion a day on agricultural subsidies, not just in this country, but in France, for example. $1 billion a day on agricultural subsidies, buying surplus crops to keep domestic agricultural production higher than would otherwise be demanded at that price. These crops are then dumped on the global markets, undercutting prices at which farmers in the developing countries can produce them. So when we subsidize the production of rice in the United States, which I believe we do, and then are paying the farmers artificially high amounts for their rice, where they then grow it, we dump that rice on the international market, which reduces the price of rice overall, and so farmers in Africa trying to grow rice at a profit get paid less. These subsidies drive out competition. The Anglican Archbishop of Southern Africa, actually the most recent one, there's a new one earlier this year, but the previous one, Njonkulu Ndungani, said if Africa could increase its share of world exports by a mere 1%, it would generate $70 million, about five times what it now receives in aid. Get the picture? Our subsidy, because people are saying, oh, those Africans, they must not be, they're either, you know, what's wrong with them that they can't work their way out of poverty? Well, they're enslaved to a global economic system that works for us, and which is why we don't know much about the Millennium Development Goals until now. Provide access to affordable essential drugs in developing countries. Some progress is being made on the availability of essential drugs. Make available the benefits of new technologies, especially for information and communications. The gap between the rich and the poor in access to technology, no surprise, is huge. All right. A word of caution, and then some focus on resources. I am very concerned about those who are focused on the MDGs and want to make a case that when we support our local food bank in Seattle, we're working on the MDGs. The MDGs make a distinction between poverty and extreme poverty.
What's an MDG?
Millennium Development Goal. You did, Maria, did you? Do you have one of these?
I do.
Okay, good. Yeah, it's just the acronym. Oh, thank you for the question. Millennium Development Goal, those eight goals we just worked through. There's a big difference between the hunger that exists in our country and the scale on which it exists in a place like Sub-Saharan Africa. The MDGs have been evolved to focus the world on the most extreme examples of poverty. All poverty should be addressed. But it is not addressing the MDGs when you work on the poverty in your local community. Now those resources, there's some great ones. And I list those there. How many have heard of Bono and his visits to George Bush and his campaign? The One campaign is very cool. You go to that website, and you got to ignore them about four times asking for your name and your support for their general campaign before they'll let you into the homepage. Oh, I think that's very cool. And then when you get in there, you sign up as an individual, and they immediately want to know, what kind of groups do you want to link this to? There's a One Lutheran campaign There's a one Episcopalian campaign. There's a one Methodist campaign. There's a one everything campaign. There are cities in California that are linked as a city to the one campaign. So it's a very cool use of networking around the advocacy goal to get the United States government to spend an additional 1% of its annual budget to help provide global health education and clean water. I urge you to go to that site. If you went there today, they would tell you what's behind the policies of Joe Biden, who gives a speech at the Democratic National Convention tonight. You know, so it's updated constantly. They are all over an analysis of the mainstream news coming at us and how it relates on this policy issue. Then the mdgmonitor.org, we talked about that earlier. You can go in there and say, I want to know the facts on how we're doing with Millennium Goal number 3 in Latin America between X year and this year. And then, boom, the data comes up. Now, data collection at the United Nations is not perfect. It's not perfect anywhere. But it's as good as it gets. And there's just a lot of data there about how we're doing. I took all the stuff I read out of this booklet called from the National Council of Churches. It's a wonderful, everything you could want to do a 6-session adult education series at your church on MDGs. You order this book and you will get all kinds of instruction for the leader, let me look at an example. One session, for example, we'll have a personal story. On goal number one, session number one, there's a personal story. There's a reflection on who is my neighbor. There's how we're doing on this goal. That's the stuff that I read from. There's the map of the regions of the world. There's some additional scripture passages. There's a tough question. Jesus said the poor will always be with us. What makes us think we can eradicate extreme poverty given the sinfulness of human nature? Isn't this just the way things are? And then some response to that. There's another box on the theological concept of poverty in the Bible. There are discussion questions for you. And then actions you can take. That's session number one. And they have the same kind of package for each one of those 6 sessions. So I'm not an expert on this stuff, as you can tell. That's why I had to read it out of the book, right? I'm only doing these sessions because I think it's urgent that we've got to start to do it. And when we do, it's an answer to prayer. The Anglican Communion, of which the Episcopal Church is a part, has been, according to the media, on the brink of complete breakdown over the issue of human sexuality and the fact that the Episcopal Church agreed to the ordination of a gay bishop, an openly gay bishop, and this has so offended some in other parts of the world. And every 10 years, the Archbishop of Canterbury brings all the Anglican bishops in the world together for a big conference. It was this summer, every 10 years, it just happened. And everybody thought, oh, the main issue is going to be human sexuality. Well, guess what? There was a small group of right-wingers, many of whom decided not to even go because they couldn't stand to be with the Americans on this issue. There were a group of people from the Episcopal Church who were saying, we're ready to do battle. And there was the big group in the middle saying, more than sex, our people are dying because of extreme poverty. And that's what we want to talk about. The American bishops who thought they were going to face all kinds of criticism about the Gene Robinson thing, they got some of it. But they got a lot more about what are your churches doing on the MDGs? Are you focused on it? Are you advocating for government policies to change the system that has our people dying faster than we can bury them? So that study guide is a good one. And then there's another one, which I will confess to you in the good tradition of confessing our sins. I will confess to you that I have not looked at yet, but I wish I had. I tried to today. It took a long time to download it, and then I saw it was 60 pages long. That's the one on the ELCA website there, the fourth one down. The third one tells you how to get that booklet that I've got right here. The fourth one tells you about another resource guide called God's Mission in the World, an Ecumenical Christian Study Guide on Global Poverty and the MDGs. It's jointly produced by the ELCA and the Episcopal Church. It's got to be good. Right? There's another one. Order one of each, you know, for a total investment of $15. And then finally, I list the e4gr.org, Episcopalians for Global Reconciliation. They probably are the most active network within the church right now, providing stuff. You sign up for their emails and you will get four a day. And be invited to a weekly conference call on what can be done and a lot of campaign, particularly in the Episcopal arena. And finally, I close with this quote from St. Teresa of Avila. Christ has no body now on earth but yours, no feet but yours, no hand but yours. Yours are the eyes through which the compassion of Christ is to look out on a hurting world. Yours are the feet with which he is to go about doing good. Yours are the hands with which he has to bless all now. All right, we still got 5 minutes for questions, or I would especially love it if anybody, let's start, before we go to questions, does anybody have stories to tell about other resources on the MDGs? Some of you have heard of them. Anybody know of other resources to share? All right. Then, Dick.
Yeah, I have to mention Plan B.
Okay.
Just finished reading it. It's by a man named Lester Brown. And Plan A is to continue on with things like they are now. Plan B is what he does is he takes the success stories from around the world to success stories in reducing hunger and reducing our carbon footprints and reducing global warming and all that, and puts them together and hopes by doing so that that more people will adapt these successful practices.
Good. And one of them, I'll bet, is 3 cups of tea, which has been on the New York Times bestseller list for a long time. How many have seen it? Yeah, good. Great. A big one is the subject of tomorrow's session, 10:50 tomorrow morning, when we look at microfinance. That's a huge effective strategy for addressing global poverty. And then the problem of water and what to do about it, which we'll focus on Friday, is another one. Plan B by, do you remember the author's name?
Yeah, Lester Brown. I forget his middle initial.
All right, anybody have questions? Any other suggestions like that? Bread for the World, I should have put them down there as a resource, because that's an advocacy resource. The work we have to do is to inform ourselves and then to use the democratic rights we have. You know, we say we have to spend billions to give these democratic rights to other countries, and that's why we go to war in those places. We don't even use the democratic rights we have. We have to educate ourselves and then use our democratic rights in an advocacy fashion.
We should probably talk about the Jubilee organization too.
Right. Jubilee is the group coordinating the campaigns to end the odious debt that is crippling the countries that I spent a little bit of time talking about. JubileeUSA.org.
What that was supposed to end in 2000, was it not? What kind of progress was made?
The campaign, yeah, the official, I mean, the woman, I forget her name, who founded that in Britain, Anne something, she didn't want to create a permanent organization. And so launched this campaign, went on, but the campaign continues because the debt continues. There has been some progress. And after a lot of lobbying by a lot of people in this country, the U.S. government did agree to some debt reduction, but it is still a big problem. And a little more debt reduction would go a long way to freeing up the resources. It has to be done in a, I mean, it doesn't have to be, but I think it should be done in a way that ties the forgiveness of the debt to investments by the government in healthcare and education, for example. But if you Google Jubilee or jubileeusa.org, you can learn more about the state of it and how to connect with it.
Well, I think something that's also connected with that is it seems we need to have some policies or some ways of not doing that same darn thing all over again and loaning money somewhere where it's going to be taken by despots and the debt, you know, left for the people to pay. I mean, are we changing how we're even doing foreign policy? That's another thing that should be addressed.
You're not a communist, are you?
No. Some people might say.
How do you do that with the free enterprise system without compromising the free enterprise system? Yeah. The banks are free to buy airplane tickets and go to those countries and negotiate loans. And that's part of the problem.
Yeah.
There's a serious block of misinformation in American public education. Bill Moyers did a show about 3 months ago about, I think it was related to the rice subsidies, but there were third generation families that did nothing but pick up a check each year for a program that Congress was afraid to stop because it was so politically entrenched. Right. Well, I think if the average young person knew that, they'd have a little healthier knowledge of the fallibilities of their own democratic system.
Alexia Salvatierra, who was teaching in the village last week, runs a public policy advocacy network in California, a Lutheran pastor. She said a couple of things. I believe she's the one who made the comment that I heard last week, and don't quote me on this because my memory is very faulty, but I believe she said it was like 10 corporations now receive 75% of U.S. farm subsidies. The aggregation of U.S. agriculture is such that the subsidies are going, most of the subsidies, they're not going to the family farm. They're going to the big farming conglomerates. And she also made a statement I'll never forget. I like it very much. She said, we're not short on compassion. We're short on vision. We don't see the problem. We're so busy reinforcing this notion that we have a free press and celebrating how we are the most advanced people in the history of the world and all this rah, 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 which, you know, I like to hear other people praise us. And you don't have to go far in this world to find our allies in Europe and people around the world who will speak to the strengths of the American people and system that they admire. We don't need to be just constantly trumpeting that ourselves. We should become a little bit more humble and ask them to tell us what they respect and then ask them also if they think there's anything can be improved. And take our information. Like I said last week about Israel and Palestine, we could be taking our information from Palestinian Christians and it would look a lot different than what we're getting from our free press about the situation in Israel. One, two, and then we're out of here.
One of the goals of the Bush administration and compassionate conservatism was to reduce government programs and funnel that through tax cuts into private individuals and theoretically into churches and so on and other charities. You find that that's working, that we're getting more done by reducing government.
Well, I think that what they had in mind was rewarding the evangelical Christian movement that had helped put Bush in office. I won't say elected him because I come from Florida and it's not clear in my mind that he was actually elected. but he was definitely supported hugely by a conservative evangelical movement. And they wanted to reward that by empowering those groups with inner-city-focused U.S. domestic social programming. That has generally not worked. I mean, there was a lot of publicity about it. I don't know how much money has ended up going there today. Anybody have data on that? We don't hear much about it anymore, the faith-based. I don't believe that much of that money ever went to the big players in this country on global poverty work, like Catholic Relief Services, Lutheran World Relief, Episcopal Relief and Development, Church World Service, Those are large organizations that take some State Department funding, but I believe that's stayed the same or reduced. It hasn't been rewarded with the faith-based funding. One more here, and then I'll invite others to ask me afterwards, because we're at an hour.
Can you address a little why, if we're so worried about our national security, we're the biggest arms dealer in the world? I mean, isn't that, like, doesn't add up making sense?
Well, it doesn't. Well, the reason is that I don't think military weaponry is worthy of as much faith that as we place in it. And the more you put into guns, the more you are exposed to those who are angry about our use of guns, basically. It's the same principle of gang violence in the inner city. The more guns that are bribed in the neighborhood, the more shooting there is, and the less safe you are. And the more we invest in military weaponry in this world, the more we are going to create enemies, the more we are going to feed the recruitment efforts of groups like Al-Qaeda. The more money we send to Israel, the more hatred there will be against the United States from significant blocks of the world.
Where does that statement fit into these 8 goals?
Well, I told you that the one of the critiques of the MDGs is that it doesn't address the issue of exporting arms. And guess who would have refused to participate if the global community had tried to address that with a MDG? I mean, who are the major arms exporters? Then the Soviet Union, Israel, United States. So, we got work to do. Thank you for raising your consciousness. Now use the new vision. You know where I have a bookshelf of kitchen staff book recommendations? Over there. It's on the second shelf. Right when you come in. Who's the author of that? Poison Wood Bible.
Oh, yes. We will be rewarded at the end of the day.
So,
that's beautiful.
It is a problem, but it's not the primary reason for Africa's lagging behind.
Just because it's
there are groups working on monitoring. But I don't think. Well, and it's not our part of the problem. You know, when you provide more the resources, for example, you say we'll cancel some of your debt if you'll provide more education. Guess what happens in time? When 1.3 more people do it, it's harder for the politicians to get it. They're empowering people, and that's the best way to fight it. He did. I'm sure there is, but I don't know. I'll bet you, you know who I bet would have that or could help you get it is Bread for the World. I'll bet you Bread for the World would track that. They're great. Yeah. Go to their website or ask them about it.
When you're listing all these religious relief organizations, I'm sure you put them forward to.
Thank you. Thank you. You're right.
Methodist.
Thank you. I will do so.
Okay.
Thank you. They are good.
Thank you, David.
Hey, Lord.
I get so discouraged, but you know that I think, well, there's hope. Things are happening.
Well, there are some things happening. There are some resources. Nope. I've heard about it, though. Thank you.
Have you read the whole thing?
No, we're over halfway.
And the upshot is that the current economic thinking of this country, the IMF,
they have their own staff, and it's big, but it's not.
Extreme monetary.
Does there want?
Economic policy.
Magnitude of problems here.
And all the people.
Sort of a recognition of the nation state is the primary vehicle.
Because those people are now in the positions of power.
I would love to read this.
They also have a bed and breakfast.
Basically, what happened in Chile with.
We haven't given up enough sovereignty.
Was because they were forcing policies in Milton.
Particularly the UN.
In Chile.
Has not given up.
That's why it happened. Because nobody wanted to.
I think right after this.
Through a Democrat.
I remember the Lumumba assassination.
And this has been happening all around the world ever since.
Yeah.
And one of the tenets is cannot forgive debt. Debt must be paid.
Kennedy had a point of.
Yep, it's a tough one.
I wanted to bring that up.
Thank you.
When you had the session, it didn't work out.
But thanks for bringing it to my attention.
So the United States was horrible.
Thank you.
Yeah, we have. Yeah, what an exchange.
Well, that's what I mean, it's just. The fact that it's my kid is probably.
Joanne, this is Dell, I didn't meet you the other day.
Steve Moan, but Dell.
Yeah, okay. You meet the gentleman that was telling me about that, whose grandmother is Preuss.
And from the same Preuss family as David and.
Yeah, you can find a book in the library about J.A.C. Preuss, when he was head of the Missouri Senate. It was written by a news reporter of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. I just went through the car catalog yesterday to see. And it talks about his life and how David, who ended up heading the ALC,